You can just imagine being a staffer in the Pentagon. A lot of us that were working these challenges and trying to really educate, write budget documents, build programs, we had been espousing this view of AI as supervised learning. We were saying to the department, look, here's where we need to invest. And I think we'd done a decent job over 3 or 4 years in Maven, demonstrating some early successes, starting to scale the technology, and then moving the bar for those investments. Then in 2022, ChatGPT drops, and you know the game in AI shifts dramatically.
What's up, everybody? I'm your host, Tyler Sweat. Welcome to another episode of All Quiet on the Second Front, the podcast where boring defense talk comes to die. Excited to have Mr. Joe Larson with us today of recent CDAO fame, current, I guess, TBD and Earl fame. One, been a huge fan, longtime friend, so thanks for making some time to come in. Two, I've had the benefit of knowing you for a little while. Some of our listeners probably haven't. To kind of kick us off, give me the once over the world. You know, who's Joe? Yeah. What are you working on?
Yeah, thank you for the invitation. This is my first in-person podcast. I think I've done a few of these over Zoom. So I really appreciate the opportunity to, you know, to you in person and catch up. Yeah, so I'm Joe Larson. For those who don't know me, I came from CDAO recently. I was one of the original deputy CDAOs for what they called algorithmic warfare. It was the warfighting portfolio within CDAO. Basically, the way the Chief Digital and AI Office of the DoD works is they divided functionally roles, and there were some focused on things like acquisition and policy. There was a business analytics lead. There were other kinds of leads. I was focused on the warfighting portfolio, and I had that role from June of 22 until my recent resignation in January of 24. Prior to that, long-term Marine, lawyer, worked in industry at several startups and been part of the technology national security game now for a couple decades. And then after I left in January 24, recently joined Anduril Industries. Actually, I'm a boomerang because I was there in the early days, and I've returned where I'm now the chief of staff and work for the CEO.
It's a pretty interesting time to be in algorithmic warfare, sort of the warfighting function, given all of the changes we saw in the AI industry over the last couple of years. Would be pretty interesting, just a broad stroke. I won't ask a pointed question, but where you've seen the impact of, you know, LLMs and generative AI and sort of the pace that that's been increasingly sort of being released at or consumed at. Where do you see the impacts of that, one, to warfare itself, but two, juxtaposed with sort of the policy of the department and the pace at which policy can or cannot keep up?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly a broad question. Maybe it'd be useful to just sort of like quickly talk about the term algorithmic warfare in the DoD. You know, maybe a minute intro would help put some context on that question. The algorithmic warfare cross-functional team, which was the original name of Project Maven, was established in 2016 by Bob Work. And so I was honored to be an active duty Marine as part of the team that stood up and ran Project Maven. And at the time, in 2016, we were a little bit of an AI lull, I'll call it that way. You know, you had tremendous advances in the 2010 to 2013-14 phase. You know, deep learning was starting to become popular. You're starting to see the success of deep learning on things like games, you know, the Go victory. And, one of the areas where AI, particularly deep learning, was getting tremendous investment and showing capability was in the space of computer vision, right? So when we started Project Maven, it was really about doing supervised learning on computer vision to do, a number of analyst-related tasks, both in full motion video and satellite imagery and other modalities, the kinds of things where you really want to do large scale pattern recognition. So, that initiative, and I think people are pretty familiar with Project Maven, there's a lot on it recently, so you can track its evolution, proceeded for a number of years. But then in 2022, in 2017, Google writes their paper, Attention is All You Need. Then we have, transformer-based architectures pop up. And then in 2022, of course, the big moment when OpenAI releases ChatGPT. So what does that mean for the Defense Department? Well, it means a lot. And you could break down sort of like the different ways that it affects the department in terms of, there's the policy ramifications. There's certainly the budget and acquisition ramifications. And at the peak of the pyramid, there's the warfighting. How do we actually apply these to like warfighting ends? Starting with some of the like budget and policy issues. You can just imagine being a staffer in the Pentagon, which I've had the opportunity to do in multiple levels in the past decade or so. And for those that know the laborious and slow planning, budget, and execution, you know, part of the department, it's very hard to move that ship, right? And so, you know, a lot of us that were working these challenges and trying to really educate, write budget documents, build programs, integrate with the PEOs and the others that build the technology, we had been sort of espousing this view of AI as supervised learning. We were saying to the department, look, here's where we need to invest. We need to invest in lots of data labeling, right? The use case is computer vision. We need to, you know, really focus in on some of these cases, making sense of, you know, our ISR, our intelligence data. And I think we'd done a decent job over 3 or 4 years in Maven, demonstrating some early successes, starting to scale the technology, and then moving the bar for those investments. And then in 2022, ChatGPT drops, and you know the game in AI shifts dramatically, right? Like now it's transformer-based architectures. It's less supervised learning. You maybe don't need as many labelers. Maybe you need a lot more access to compute, right? You need a lot more chips. You know, you can pull the semantics from the data itself. You know, the return of the data scientist and the critical role they play in the enterprise, the switch from imagery-based and computer vision-based to more language-based applications. So now I've got, you know, you have to go back to the Department of Defense and say, hey, you know all those things we were investing in, those are all still really important, but now we want to do even more and we want to spread into new directions. And I think, you know, the main challenge you face at a place like CDAO is how you move a ship like the Department of Defense at the speed of relevance for the technology. We watched last year when generative AI hit, Microsoft on a dime, you know, drops a $10 billion investment in OpenAI, and Amazon drops $4 billion on Anthropic, tens of billions of dollars of venture capital flowing into startups in the generative AI space. Regardless of what you feel about the technology, and, you know, I'd be happy to go into what I think are the strengths and limits of the technology, that level of energy, investment, money, time, talent getting poured into a technology means, by definition, there's going to be utility there, right? There's going to be value. And so the question is, you know, the department does not have the mechanisms by which to say, hey, in the 24 budget, we're going to drop $5 billion on generative AI, or we're going to drop $10 billion. That's not the way the Department of Defense works, right? Most of the procurement dollars are in MDAPs, major defense acquisition programs. They run for 20 years. We've got $2 trillion locked up in spending on these MDAPs. We got $170 billion in the fiscal year 24 budget locked up in procurement. So, you know, getting the department to make major investments in these kinds of technologies that are very complicated technologies, they're tricky for warfighting application, and doing it at the scale that's meaningful, it's tremendously hard to move that building. And so I know CDAO has been focused in on that. I had the opportunity to help stand up Task Force Lima, which is the Generative AI Task Force. They're taking this approach of really starting with the diagnosis of the use cases, right? And saying, what are the actual applications of the technology to warfighting? And let's use that as the basis for then backtracking to the investments that matter. And I know they're deep in that process now. That's been running for several months. And, you know, I'm pretty pleased with the progress.
You know, when you talk about the ability for, you know, your Microsoft and your Amazon to be dropping, you know, tens of billions of dollars on a dime. Hey, this is a big thing. We're gonna over-index on it. You know, recognizing that the department can't necessarily move like that or reprogram like that. How have you seen, you know, I guess up until your time departing, the ability for policy to sort of keep pace, right? And I'm often brought back to sitting in a room, that's probably 8 months ago, with, we'll call it, a cross-functional departmental leadership team. And one branch has a memo that says no LLMs and no generative AI. And the other branch is building LLMs to roll out in. And you're sitting there with all of these CTOs kind of looking at like, okay, like who's going to take a leadership role in this policy? And can the department, you know, ensure safe use and that, you know, we're rolling it out with trust and all of that, but also not completely miss sort of like a technological hurdle?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I think generative AI is interesting technology because it basically challenges every aspect of the department's concerns around the reliability and safety of the technology it procures and delivers, right? Like my old boss, Dr. Martel, when I was at CDAO, you know, would highlight often that generative AI on its face does not meet the DoD's AI ethical principles, right? In a lot of ways, we can run through how they're not reliable, they're not governable, right? There's issues there. I definitely think keeping the policy up to date with the speed of technology is a tremendous challenge. However, that being said, one of the issues that I think the Pentagon often suffers from is a misunderstanding the span of control they have over their own enterprise. And I call it the F-150 problem, which is, you know, when I started as a young Marine lieutenant, intel analyst, and I had access to ChatGPT, I imagine what I would have done had it been banned on DoD networks is I would have gone to my F-150 on my lunch break, opened up my cell phone, and used ChatGPT anyway. And I say that, hopefully the security people don't turn me in for that. This is a hypothetical, the ubiquity of the technology, the availability of the technology, the integration of the technology and the way we do things, you know, every day, right? And it's integration in the products that we use, the way the major technology companies who really provide the backbone of the way we run our daily lives are starting to integrate these technologies. I feel it's not reasonable for the department to take this, really risk averse approach and say, we'll ban. You know, I think banning is not a great approach. I think a stronger approach is to identify those use cases that have meaning, invest in making those use cases work, and then in through the execution of those use cases and through experimentation, you can provide real examples of where it does or does not have utility and where that utility is balanced by an equal set of risks that come with it. You know, and those risks are not just, by the way, hallucinations that the algorithm will, you know, spit out something incorrect. In many ways, I think the greater concern for the department is the expert bias of the algorithms. The idea that that if an AI tells me it, it's not only that it's factually correct, but that it actually represents the best aggregated knowledge and insight that's possible is a real issue. You know, if I were to say, I'm planning this military activity and, hey, large language model, give me three courses of action. It gives me three courses of action and ranks them. I'm likely to, this confirmation bias, I'm likely to assume that's true. So the risks are pretty substantial. I think, the department is making the right moves here, which is identifying the use cases and really doing this in experimental ways, right? Like run the LLMs, bring the models, bring all forms of generative models to these things like the global information dominance experiments, run them, get the metrics, understand how they operate, see their failure modes, and then start a communication with our warfighter, who, by the way, is sophisticated, right? Particularly the younger generation are increasingly comfortable with the idea that the technology that's delivered to them by a program of record, if it's to be relevant, may not be perfect, right? Because speed requires us to do things pretty fast. Yeah, exactly.
You know, so as you... You talk about sort of the pace of change in and around AI. I want to sort of flip it a little bit and say, you know, from the Anduril side of the house, as you're looking at not just the sort of increased volume and velocity of, you know, AI, generative AI changes, but also juxtaposed with the geopolitical changing environment, Ukraine and Gaza and sort of everything in between the Red Sea, everything that's sort of happening right now. Both, you know, maybe traditional sort of conflicts and asymmetric. Where are you guys seeing the biggest implication for future of warfare and what we think that's going to look like sort of in the next decade or two?
Yeah, I mean, the story at the Pentagon is very interesting because CDAO stood up in 2022. And I think when we look back in history, the year 2022 will be seen as a very pivotal year for the integration of technology and military application for two reasons. First of all, obviously, we've had the generative AI we've discussed. But when we look at the Russian invasion of Ukraine and we see a shifting character of warfare, that's every day there's innovations being brought on the battlefield that have tremendous implications for our entire .mlpf, the way we fight, the way we organize, the way we train, there's a lot to learn there. And so, you know, I certainly applaud the department's many efforts to understand and begin to think about how we apply the lessons of Ukraine. So when I look at Ukraine, I'll just give you a sense of, you know, from the Anduril hat, you know, some of the lessons we're pulling out of it. One of them is, you know, certainly that a modern military that relies for the projection of its power on its most complicated, sophisticated, exquisite equipment is potentially putting themselves at great risk, right? You know, the Russian military in advance of the invasion of Ukraine was modern and lethal. It had undergone a decade-long program of modernization. It had the most advanced fighter jets. They were believed to dominate the skies. It had modern tanks, and they were investing in even better tanks. And it had sensing, right? It had Group 5 UAS and had access to space-based capabilities. And it was believed at the time they would roll right over. And obviously that didn't happen. And what we're seeing is really a bunch of things come together, which is, you know, anything that exists on a battlefield today can be seen. And if it can be seen, it can be targeted, right? The ability of sensors to pick up things from space, whether visually or through a mission, the ability of AI to sort through that and make sense of it, and then the ability to get a mass effects on something has been demonstrated in Ukraine. And, you know, Bob Work, the great, you know, former Deputy Secretary of Defense who started Project Maven, you know, once gave the example that, you know, I never saw a war game where the F-35 didn't dominate in the skies, but then when it's sitting on the ground, it's just a hunk of metal, right? And we see that in Ukraine. You know, a vignette I would show recently is the Avdiivka attacks on 21 February, where the Ukrainians used these FPV-2 drones with repeaters and launched them into hangars and took out millions of dollars of exquisite Russian equipment with a few thousand dollars of drones. And that, to me, exemplifies, you know, the future of warfare, right, where it's going to be, and this is tied a lot to the department's investments in things like Replicator, I think are very smart, where you get mass not through sophisticated and exquisite capabilities, but through many small, smart, and available technologies. So that's kind of the way we're leading at Anduril. That's not to say you don't need your high-end platforms. I would just say they need to be augmented with an equivalent investment in, you know, in an era of distributed targeting.
You know, as you talk about that sort of diffusion of power from a symmetry standpoint, where are you seeing the department more comfortable sort of leaning in? I know Replicator, I think, is the easiest example just because it's in the news all the time. But to go back to sort of the first example around, hey, you know, the department's ability to pivot, the department's ability to make bets, the department's ability to have some sort of fiscal or programmatic agility really is sort of desynchronized by an order of magnitude from what we're seeing now on the ground. Where are you seeing signs? Like, what gets Anduril excited as you look at the department? Where are you seeing positive steps there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the Replicator itself shows that the department has an understanding, right, of the nature of the changing, shifting nature of warfare, not nature of warfare, character of warfare that we're seeing in Ukraine, and is willing to make those investments. You know, to be quite candid with your question was kind of like, find the optimism, and I probably am more inclined to find the pessimism, you know, in the sense that these things are interesting, but I think when you break apart and you say, hey, you know, really the department is $2 trillion of major defense acquisition programs. If you read the GAO's report in 2023 on the MDAPs, it said, you know, most of the money in these programs, $47 billion in cost overruns, most of that was on things like software modernization, you know, lack of supply chain resilience. In the Pentagon today, while we talk a lot about why the external discussion is a lot about artificial intelligence and high-end technology, I would say in the Pentagon, the question really these days is around the ability to produce at scale, right? Do we have the capacity to do the manufacturing we need to keep up with our adversaries in the event of a fight? I think we're all very frightened when we see things like the recent CSIS war game against China, where the U.S. basically depleted its inventory of high-end munitions that were required within a period of days, right, with really no industrial base to back that up. So when I see where am I hopeful that I think the Pentagon does understand that these are real challenges. I think that, you know, recognizing you have a problem is the first step to fixing that problem. And I'm seeing, you know, I think on both sides, you know, you're starting to see significant investments in thinking through how we deal with the production level and capacity level challenges to be able to produce what we need to produce to compete with adversaries at scale, and how we're doing, more research and development activities and integrating artificial intelligence into our actual programs of records and real platforms, right, which is where the money is spent. And so there are some positive steps being taken forward there.
I'll take that as positive. Yeah. You know, as you talk about the need to scale production, some of the emerging technology, some of the advancements we're seeing in the pace of change, I'm brought back, you know, we spent the first chunk of this talking about the technological side of it. Let's talk about the people. I think Anduril's sort of like a household name in defense tech, you know, I guess you're technically still a startup. Talk to me about, you know, competition for talent and what are you seeing? I know there's a bunch of, you know, media right now around sort of like a defense renaissance and all of that, at least from the capital side. What are you guys seeing for competing for sort of top talent in the defense and national security arena?
Yeah, I mean, I think the fight for talent is the most important of the battles we've described. We can talk about, you know, production capacity. We can talk about the strengths and limits of the technology. We can talk about the policy implications. At the end of the day, none of those matter as much as getting the smartest people in the world to work on that. And I think you know, on the Anduril side, there's really two stories to tell. The first is how you get our smartest minds of our generation focused in on national security problems in the first place. And that's probably the real proximate challenge. I had the opportunity last year to go speak at a major AI conference in San Francisco, not really the kind of place the DoD speaks typically. And when I asked how many people in the room had ever worked on a national security project, and there were hundreds of people in the room, only a handful of hands went up. So, you know, the best way to enhance our talent base is, you know, not necessarily for the Anduril's to be competing with the other, you know, startups in the defense tech space, or God forbid with the government for talent, right? The best way to do it is to make a story about why talent needs to be working on these problems in the first place. This is something I think that has improved dramatically in the last few years, as people have seen in Ukraine that the threat of authoritarianism, of aggressive militaries making steps that were previously thought impossible are in fact possible. And I believe that, you know, there's a moral narrative around doing this work that has captured the attention of many. Obviously, there's just a lot of people who won't do this kind of work, and that's fine, you know, in no way would. But I do think you're seeing more and more people that recognize that there's value in protecting the American way of life by investing in our national security enterprise, and that we're challenged to get the talent base to do that. So, you know, I've been very encouraged by that, you know, particularly as people have seen what's happened with Ukraine and Russia. So that's one. And then two is, you know, how do we get them to work at Anduril versus other places? One of the things, you know, we believe in is, you know, we build products that we believe in, right? That's kind of the idea is, you know, nobody really tells us what to build at the outset. It's based on what is the cutting edge of the technology, where do we think we can make a meaningful product, where is there a customer that's demonstrated a need for this product, come join our team, and you can build something from the ground up, from scratch, to have, I think it's a very different approach then, you know, maybe a more traditional, and there's nothing wrong with the traditionals, but if you're doing a requirements-based kind of build, right, you don't have that kind of leeway to invest in the internal, you know, the IRAD to make your product better. You can't really iterate as quickly. It's a lot more fun to build things in a laboratory and then roll them out as products than it is to build things to spec. And so I think that aspect of the build has played really well for the company and attracted a lot of really talented engineers that want to come aboard and do something that matters. The other thing I'll say, you know, on that point is, you know, the integration of software and hardware is a critical story here. I'm sorry, my watch is going off here. The story of Anduril is one of integrated products, right? It doesn't sell. And so I think there's a lot of software engineers that like the idea of seeing their work actually manifest in a platform that does something. It flies, it goes under
it's
the
tangible,
sea.
Yeah.
It's tangible. You know, people buy it in bulk. They can go see it in the field. And that, you know, that aspect of it, I think, you know, particularly for young engineers looking to, you know, that are doing this because they want to have an impact and they want to be able to iterate, that's a really powerful motivation.
Okay. I like that. All right, last two questions. One, sort of just a rapid fire. Biggest change for you coming from sort of senior in DoD to chief of staff at, like, arguably the most well-known defense company out there. What surprised you the most, or what was the biggest change?
Well, not that much super surprised me because I had the opportunity to bounce back and forth. Yeah. But I will say that, you know, the biggest cultural difference I feel is just the, you know, the ability of an organization at scale to communicate information and manage through its modern processes. This is something that we desperately missed in the government. I'm a big believer in the criticisms of the Pentagon, where you see that it hasn't moved past the 1950s, you know, sort of like business process. That is totally true. You know, the minute I walk into a meeting in the Pentagon, I have no cell phone, I have no laptop. Meetings are highly structured. They're run off of PowerPoints. In many cases, not even, you know, PowerPoints, but print offs of PowerPoints, because you can't display, you can't show a video, you can't hit the cloud, right, to show software as a service. Yep. And, you know, and then I go back into industry. And of course, that's not the way we run our business. It's it's run using modern cloud.
All the information's right up
there. All the information is available. And, you know, there are moments in time where if I'm not on Slack, if I'm not checking my messages, I could be 5 or 10 minutes behind, and major decisions have been made and processes have moved. It requires you to be plugged in. And I think that's a huge advantage industry has that the Defense Department doesn't have, is they move in minutes versus, you know, the Pentagon moves in days, weeks, and months. So that's probably, you know, I would say, even though I only left for a couple of years to come back into government, I was shocked when I came back into industry that, it, you know, that momentum has continued and the iteration cycle is much faster.
It's funny. I was fortunate to support Naval X down at South by Southwest. They were doing a reverse pitch where government leaders were coming and sort of pitching their solutions, their ideas, their approaches to different problems. And they had industry on the panel instead of, you know, government sort of voting on. And my biggest takeaway every time was like, hey, you guys aren't understanding like the relative value of a minute to a startup, to a private company versus you. Like, time doesn't exist in the Pentagon. Time is the only currency at an earlier stage company.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, and that's just a function of the size and the scale of what the Pentagon deals with. When we pitched AI to the Pentagon, there wasn't even really a way to run an AI issue paper through the budget cycle because they're not structured to do that, right? And, you know, and the Pentagon's planning for 26, 27, 28 budgets right now, you know, 25 is basically locked in. And how do you deal with that environment when you have to pivot and say, actually, we need to invest in something at scale in the next 3 to 6 months? So, you know, certainly it's going to continue to be an issue for them to move at the speed of relevance for industry.
All right, last question for you. We've talked about a whole bunch today, but, you know, if Joe was king for a day, you had a magic wand, you could make one change, and you don't have to caveat it. Like, as you know, your intent is manifested. What's the one thing you change and why?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think it would be within the DoD at a program level. I would wave a magic wand and change the culture of what it means to run a initiative in the DoD in a program at scale. And I've worked on these programs, so I understand the, you know, the inertia and the temptations that go into there. And I certainly see many today that are embracing innovative practices. You know, they're using innovative forms of acquisition, or they're trying to do things like on sprints, or bring in AI that may not be purely written by their requirements. I still think those tend to be the exception rather than the rule. And I worry a little bit that for all of the discussion about the advances of the DoD in the space of innovation, it hasn't really touched the major defense acquisition programs and the PEOs, which is where $170 billion of procurement dollars go. So if I were to wave a magic wand, what I would do is, you know, I would bring a wave of creativity and thought process on how to achieve my requirements using alternative means to those major PEOs, and, you know, see if you couldn't have some big successes in moving our programs faster.
Yeah.
Right. And that's not a criticism of those that do this, by the way. I've done it. It's extremely hard work. Every one of our PEOs is managed by an extraordinary American, you know, or a Five Eye partner in some cases. And they're absolutely doing the best they can in a very hard environment. So in no way is that a personal criticism. It's more of just a cultural criticism of the overall DoD and the way it operates.
Yeah. You almost want to give those amazing people more latitude and more ability to get after it versus having them sort of stuck in that confined sort of process to execute in.
Exactly. And that's not a challenge within the PEOs. That's probably a cultural and structural change that has to happen across the entirety of the DoD.
Agreed. Well, look, brother, it's always a pleasure to get to spend some time together. I'm excited to watch you continue to do tremendous things for the nation at Anduril. And champion you guys from the sidelines. And thanks for coming by today.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, everybody. Cheers.